From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. China's Navy is making the rounds, and a task force came to port in fellow BRICS member South Africa with three Chinese warships that docked outside Cape Town. The naval fleet is on a four-day visit to strengthen ties with the South African Navy, and members of the public were invited to tour the ships. CCTV's Travers Andrews was there and filed this report.
The 22nd Escort Task Group has been busy in the tense and troubled waters of the Gulf of Aden. Now they're in Simonstown, the home of the South African Navy. It's a goodwill visit, but serious business too.
It's cooperation with the Chinese Navy is something that we've been looking forward to. We have many engagements with many international role players, but the Chinese ones seem to be unique. Since 2008, People's Liberation Army Navy has sent task groups here. This is the third task group visiting us, and the first of the task group to visit Simonstown Harbour in particular.
Members of the public were allowed to tour the ships. For Cape Town's Chinese community, it was a big moment.
I feel very proud today and very, very happy because I see the Chinese Navy come to Cape Town. Yeah, such a very beautiful city. I work here. I'm very honored today.
So all the Chinese people feel very happy because China used to be not very strong, and now the country getting strong.
Besides the fanfare, the visit also signals both navies want to work together. Upon their departure, the Chinese Navy will also be participating in naval exercises with their South African counterparts.
We have arranged that one of our frigates and submarines must actually exercise with the task group out at sea. And that also signifies the first exercise of that magnitude.
For now, though, after a lengthy spell at sea, the Chinese sailors can look forward to a little local hospitality. Travers Andrews, CCTV, Simonstown Naval Base, Cape Town.
A plan to airdrop aid to besieged locations across Syria could be implemented despite continuing difficulties reaching desperate communities across the war-torn country. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry unveiled a proposal after a meeting of the International Syria Support Group in Vienna Tuesday. Matthew Wells filed this report from the United Nations.
The World Food Programme, WFP, which has already been involved in coordinating airdrops to the eastern besieged town of Deir Ez-Zor, would be involved in an extended aerial aid operation if the UN is denied access by road, Mr. Kerry said. UN Special Envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, confirmed the plan and said that only 12 out of 18 besieged locations have been reached to date. According to Mr. de Mistura, no date has yet been set for the resumption of peace talks in Geneva. He said the sticking point was that renewed outbursts of fighting had undermined the fragile truce, which made negotiations between government and opposition groups possible. Whereas around 80% of the fighting had stopped earlier in the year, the current level was more like 50%, said the envoy. In a statement following the meeting, the ISSG said it welcomed the joint statement from Russia and the US of last week, saying they would intensify efforts to stop the fighting and help restore the necessary conditions for talks to continue. Matthew Wells, United Nations.
Members of the so-called International Libya Support Group pledged support for the newly formed Government of National Accord, or GNA. They plan to supply weapons to the government, which has control only of portions of the country, ostensibly to fight terrorism. This was U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry laying out the so-called support group's demands in Vienna Monday.
First, the House of Representatives must take a vote on the GNA and honor the Jarat Agreement. And the international community can help that by being present when that takes place. Second, the unified Libyan government must move forward to counter Daesh and other terrorist groups through the joint command under civilian authority. Three, the international community must support the Presidency Council decision on GNA entry into the ministries so that the government can begin to provide Libyans with essential services. Fourth, humanitarian aid to the Libyan people must be accelerated. Fifth, the international community will support the Presidency Council as it seeks exemption from the UN arms embargo to acquire those weapons and bullets needed to fight Daesh and other terrorist groups.
Abiyomi Ezekwe is the publisher of the Pan-African Newswire. He raised issues over whether the U.S. should involve itself further in Libya.
I don't think it's a method to bring stability to Libya. It was the United States that created the conditions for the growth of the Islamic State in Iraq and later in Syria, now in Libya, where there is a political vacuum in existence. I think that the United States has to be honest about its overall intentions in Libya. They have destroyed the country. They've turned it into one of the major sources of human trafficking across North Africa, the Mediterranean, into southern, eastern, and central Europe. They've created the worst humanitarian crisis since the conclusion of World War II, with some 60 million refugees and internally displaced persons. I don't think they can create a solution for a problem that they, in fact, are responsible for bringing into existence.
RT's Peter Oliver was in Vienna Monday when the Libyan support group met, and he filed this report.
We understand that the United States and its allies want to see exemptions made to the UN-imposed arms embargo on Libya. Well, the embargo was put in place following the NATO-led airstrikes against Libya that led to the toppling of Muammar Gaddafi. And that led to the country slipping into turmoil, a turmoil in which it remains to this day. Well, the exemptions that they want to see relate to the internationally recognized government of Libya. Now, this all comes about from a communique. It says that the US and others are ready to respond to the government requests for arms and for training, despite, as I said, the country remaining in rather a mess on the ground. Well, European allies of the US will also be looking to try and tackle the proposition of Libya becoming the new big jumping off point for refugees trying to make it to Europe, trying to make that perilous crossing over the Mediterranean. That's following the closing off of the so-called Balkan route. And they may believe that supplying these weapons may be the best solution to do that right now, despite the risks.
For more on that, we have this report from RT's Andrew Farmer.
Well, the power struggle inside Libya has raged for years with no group in control of the whole country. And that's allowed Islamic State to expand along the coast. Only the Mediterranean Sea separates them from Europe. But let's get more analysis now from Marco Gasic. He's an international affairs commentator and joins us live from London. Good evening to you, Marco. Firstly, we're hearing there some people are sceptical about this announcement, but what do you make of this decision to arm the recognised government?
Well, I don't know what there is to recognise here, because what we have to recognise, first of all, is that there's a degree of chaos in Libya. There are alliances which are shifting, which are in a state of flux, and which you can't predict probably more than a couple of months ahead. It makes no sense to be pouring arms into troubled Libyan waters, because all we're going to do effectively is give one side the encouragement to attack the other side to create more refugees and more problems for Libya and the wider region.
The argument that's given is that obviously ISIL needs to be tackled. So I suppose the logic is, OK, well, if you put more arms into the country and give them to the government, then of course they can attack ISIL.
Well, the problem is, of course, that ISIL won't be the only side that will be attacked, because, of course, when a side has weapons, it will use those weapons against all its enemies as convenient. It's not going to have a glass ceiling between one set of enemies and the other. It will simply act in a pragmatic way to achieve its self-interest. So there is absolutely no guarantee that these weapons will purely be used against ISIL, and they are far more likely to be used against all other sides as well, with the negative consequences for the stability of Libya and also for the chance of creating an inclusive solution for the peoples of Libya. Because with an increase in killing, an upscale of killing, we're not going to get less polarisation, we're going to get more.
What do you make of the timing of this? I mean, it's been known for some time that ISIL is a problem there. Why do you think they've only decided now to make this announcement?
Well, it seems to be designed to take away the attention from where ISIL really is, which is in Syria and Iraq, and perhaps you could argue in headquarters at Turkey, Qatar, and CIA HQ in Virginia. So this is really to take attention away from where ISIS is far more dangerous, far more preponderant. This is really a distraction. I don't think we should really be being distracted.
Is there a danger too it could inflame the refugee crisis here? I suppose they would argue that no, it won't. It will help keep it under control by imposing stability, if you like. But I mean, we've seen things like this go wrong before.
Obviously, because all when a side loses, and one side here will be trying to make the other side lose, the other sides lose around it, the result, the net result, will be more refugees from the losing sides who will not feel secure, not feel safe in land dominated by the victor. So those refugees will require to leave, to go somewhere. Where will they go? They will go north, most probably to Europe, because, of course, now that Colonel Gaddafi has been replaced by a total mess, the only industry that exists in Libya at the moment, that's in local hands, is people trafficking of refugees to the north. The oil is in the hands of the West, the people are in the hands, in their own hands, but they will be heading north as a result of conflicts if those conflicts are escalated.
Press TV's Kobi Tavwe has more on the situation in Libya.
Libya descended into chaos after the ouster of Muammar Gaddafi 5 years ago and soon turned into a battleground for rival militant groups. The power vacuum has allowed the ISIL to expand its operations. The recently formed government has been slowly asserting authority in Tripoli, but it still faces a rival administration in the east. James Dutras is a former U.S. Senate foreign policy analyst joining us from Washington. James Dutras, the two governments still in control of their own territories in Libya, one's internationally UN-backed, the other not, and they've failed to actually reconcile. Is it too soon for this type of communique to be issued from the Libya meeting in terms of the weapons to be provided to the governments?
Certainly. I mean, there are so many aspects of this that are plainly just surreal. First off, we have to look at this as a prime illustration of the fact that it's much easier to wreck a country than to put it back together again. We're talking about sending weapons into Libya after years following that the collapse of the Gaddafi government, his murder, Hillary Clinton cackling, we came, we saw, he died, and then sending Libyan weapons to places like Syria. Now we want to bring more weapons back into Syria and having into Libya and having wrecked this country now. This reminds me of Colin Powell's so-called pottery barn rule. You break it, you pay for it. That we have come in, the so-called international community, led by the Obama administration and then the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, destroyed this country, and now they want to send a bill to the American taxpayers and the taxpayers of other countries to pour money in to try to put Humpty Dumpty back together. The whole thing is wrong from so many different perspectives. Finally, the idea that we have to do this to oppose Daesh. How did these guys get in there in the first place? How did these terrorists get in there in the first place? Because we overthrew Gaddafi.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about how Libya has been torn apart. I think it was in two phases. One is the U.S.-backed NATO war that was imposed, and then you had the proxy wars that were going on with the UAE, Qatar, Turkey, Egypt, Saudi Arabia on opposing sides. When Kerry talks about the international community, does he have all these countries on one page in terms of making sure that they're fighting the Daesh or ISIL there?
Well, at least tentatively, if you have the Security Council on board saying we should support the government of national accord, I guess in principle you could say there's some kind of consensus there, but whether that really reflects what's going on in the country, which still is in a chaotic circumstance, is another thing entirely. Let's remember, the Security Council also signed off on a protective mission for Benghazi, which then led to regime change by the United States and NATO. So I don't know that there's necessarily the substance on the ground that reflects at least an initial agreement among the Security Council members.
And there's also lots of reports indicating that there are UK operatives on the ground there, not to mention also US operatives. And of course, there's some that are deducting that perhaps they're scoping the grounds to pave the way, perhaps, for some kind of military intervention, even though they've stated they're not going to do that in this in the meeting in Vienna. Do you think that there's a possibility of that?
Oh, I think there's a huge possibility, probability. Look, we've got, as you say, U.S. troops on the ground in Libya. We now have them in Yemen. People are not talking about that. We have them in Iraq. We have them in Syria. How many boots on the ground wars is Obama going to try to sneak the United States into before he leaves office?
The new government in Brazil is coming under pressure from abroad as regional countries refuse to recognize it. As reported earlier, a number of countries in Latin America, including Venezuela, Cuba, Ecuador, El Salvador, Bolivia, and more, are supporting the suspended President Dilma Rousseff and challenging the authority of her temporary successor, Michel Temer. Rousseff's Workers' Party said the impeachment proceedings amount to a soft coup and that they would fight it out in the streets. Dr. Gerald Horn is an author and professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. Speaking with Black Agenda Report's Glenn Ford, he said the right-wing move against Rousseff has to be understood within a global context.
It's certainly a coup d'etat through so-called parliamentary means, but you have to see it in the context of a larger counteroffensive by the right wing in the Americas. You can say that it started with the coup in Honduras in 2009. You could say that it accelerated with the death of Hugo Chavez, and now with his successor, President Maduro, on the ropes. You can say that it accelerated further with the dislodging of Cristina Kirchner from the leadership of Argentina, and with the loss of the referendum in Bolivia that would have extended the term of President Evo Morales. And this impending removal of Dilma Rousseff has to be seen in that wider context. Now, I think the question we should ask ourselves is how and why it is that the right wing has been able to gain so much strength in the Americas. I think part of it has to do with the slowdown of the global economy. Keep in mind that the rise of the left in the Americas was to a certain extent based upon the Chinese juggernaut. That is to say, China buying up oil from Venezuela and soybeans and agricultural products from Brazil. But with the slowdown in China, that slowed down the economies of the South American nations. And of course, the constant interference of U.S. imperialism certainly has to be factored into the equation. I'm sure you know the old joke about why is it that there is relative political stability in Washington, but not throughout the hemisphere. And of course, the answer is that there's no U.S. embassy in Washington, D.C. And so when you look at what's going on in Brazil, you have to put it into this wider context. But I'm optimistic still about Brazil. That is to say that the Workers' Party has suffered a setback. There's no doubt about that. But already you can see that there is a bit of anger towards the incoming administration of so-called President Temer, who, as you know, has appointed an all-male, all-white cabinet, who was appointed a creationist as Minister of Science and Technology. And so I think that already he's stumbling out of the starting gate, which gives me hope for the future for Brazil.
Well, let's talk about the racial aspect of this. We saw that the demonstrations against Dilma Rousseff seemed to be comprised of folks who were overwhelmingly white in a country that is at least half African descended.
You are correct. And there's little doubt that the Workers' Party had garnered a substantial percentage of the vote in African-derived communities, because keep in mind that the signature program of the Workers' Party were these transfer programs, whereby the analysis was is that the problem with regard to poverty is that poor people don't have enough money, surprise, surprise, and therefore it's the role of the government to put money into their pockets, so that they will have money to buy clothes for their children and food for their children. In fact, programs were constructed to give incentives to parents, material incentives, to parents who made sure that their kids attended school every day. Now, those programs are on the ropes, and as a result, you're going to have a lot of angry working class people, a lot of angry black people in Brazil.
Yes, the Workers' Party government raised about 30% of the population out of poverty. But when those commodity prices, when the bottom fell out of that market, the Workers' Party turned to austerity.
Well, certainly there are a number of criticisms that can be made of the Rousseff regime. I've been reading the press, and There have been criticisms of her leadership style, for example, that she was not friendly enough, that she wasn't adept at building coalitions. We know that the parliament in Brazil has about 24 parties, and in order to effectuate a winning parliamentary program, you have to build relationships with these diverse parties. And there is a nugget, a kernel of truth in many of those analyses. But as with regard to the United States, I would say with regard to Brazil, that is to say that it would be a mistake to analyze either the United States or Brazil on solely national terms, that you have to look at the global environment, you have to look at the global correlation of forces, and the global correlation of forces, which seemed to be promising from 2011 till about 2014, are not as promising as they were during that earlier period.
And in terms of the long arm of the United States, we of course know that the United States spied on Dilma Rousseff, and she went to the UN General Assembly and denounced the Obama administration for doing that. But they also spied intensely on Petrobras, the state oil company. And many Brazilians suspect that the United States shared what it learned about Petrobras in terms of corruption with the enemies of the Workers' Party.
Well, when you mentioned the state oil company of Brazil, Petrobras, that's another piece of the puzzle. That is to say that about a year ago, oil prices were about $100 a barrel or $110 a barrel. Now, they're about 45. A few weeks ago, they were as low as 30. And that's put a hole not only in the budget of Brazil, but in the budget of Angola and Nigeria and Russia and Venezuela, etc. That's why I'm suggesting that in order to do an analysis of Brazil, you have to look at these mega factors, these global factors. And with there being little prospect as of now of a rise in the price of a barrel of oil, obviously all of those countries I just mentioned are going to have to scramble and come up with a new development strategy based upon a sinking price of oil as opposed to a rising price of oil.
Dilma Rousseff and her Workers' Party say that they will take this battle to the streets, since it's obviously not going to be won in this legislature. What forces will she be mobilizing or attempt to mobilize?
Well, the forces we've just made reference to, poor working class black folk in the first place. I foresee a plethora of tactics and strategies unleashed in the streets of Brazil. I foresee boycotts. I foresee sit-down strikes. I foresee occupations of key buildings in the capital, Brasilia. I think that during the Olympics, where the global spotlight will be on Brazil, there will be an exhibition by poor working class black folk to express their disapproval of what's going on in their country.
And what about the military? This new government of Temer, who attracts only the support of about 2% of the population, and because of his own corruption, has been barred from running for office, would seem to lack legitimacy. And one might see the military step into that kind of void.
Well, that is the $64 question. Keep in mind that Brazil has experienced many bitter decades in the 20th century of military rule. But once again, I'm afraid that this is not something that's limited to Brazil. Look at the polls that have just come out in the Military Times in the United States of America, which suggest overwhelming support, particularly in the officer corps, for the presidential candidacy of Donald J. Trump. This is nothing new. The officer corps in the United States historically has leaned to the right. This is why, once again, you cannot necessarily rule out not only a soft coup in Brazil, but you cannot rule out machinations by the U.S. officer corps in the United States of America.
Shades of that movie and book, 7 Days in May.
I'm afraid so. I mean, I think to a certain extent, I think that many of our friends on the left were sort of living in a fool's paradise. they have all this blather about democracy and all of that, and not analyzing the labor movement, not analyzing the U.S. officer corps, not analyzing regionally states like Mississippi, asking why it is that there's this astonishing cross-class coalition of the poor whites and the rich whites in voting for the same candidate. I mean, we have a lot of questions that we have to answer.
Last week, as people waited for the outcome of the Senate proceedings against Rousseff, Glenn Ford offered this commentary about what was coming and why.
If the Brazilian politicians that are clamoring to impeach President Dilma Rousseff were opposed to corruption, they would impeach themselves, since 60% of them are facing some kind of corruption charges. Rousseff is personally squeaky clean. Her nominal offense was manipulating budget numbers so that her government could continue programs to help the poor after the bottom fell out of the economy because of the global economic slowdown. But the actual charge against Rousseff almost never came up when the lower house of the Brazilian legislature voted to impeach her, which is why the Speaker of the lower house briefly ruled the impeachment vote null and void, and then reversed himself less than a day later, clearing the way for the Senate to put Rousseff on trial and remove her from office. Dilma Rousseff's Workers' Party and its allies on the left, like MST, the Landless Workers' Movement, call the impeachment drive a soft coup and see the long arm of the United States at work. In 2013, Rousseff stood at the United Nations General Assembly in New York to denounce the Obama administration for spying on her. The U.S. spy masters didn't get anything on Rousseff, who is clean, but they dug up plenty on the giant Brazilian state oil company Petrobras, which is at the center of a web of corruption involving billions of dollars in bribery and payoffs to politicians and businessmen affiliated with a whole range of Brazilian political parties, including, of course, Rousseff's Workers' Party. The scandal exposed the entire system as pervasively corrupt, but only Rousseff and her party are in the crosshairs. The Brazilian left says it will take the battle to the streets and mobilize internationally to defeat the soft legislative coup. But sympathizers outside of Brazil must wonder, how did it come to this? How did a party that since 2002 has won majorities of the national vote, even after the economy turned sour, find itself being hounded out of executive power by yelping packs of thoroughly corrupt political hyenas? The Workers' Party had a huge national following, but it makes up only about 15% of the country's legislature. Early on, its charismatic leader, Lula da Silva, made alliances with parties to his right at the state and national level. The more the Workers' Party became enmeshed with its capitalist partners of convenience, the further it moved from its grassroots support. The Workers' Party embraced neoliberal austerity when times got rough and shared cabinet positions and campaign funds with its erstwhile right-wing friends. This relationship was apparently reflected in the realm of corruption as well, with a host of parties sharing in the feast. All the while, the deeply reactionary and vicious Brazilian ruling class, which controls the monopoly media, awaited its chance to destroy the Workers' Party, even at the risk of economic and social chaos. This soft coup could turn very, very hard very quickly. The left hangs by a thread in Brazil and has been ousted in Argentina and is halfway out the door in Venezuela because the power of the capitalists in those countries remained intact. Capitalism is the ultimate corruption that never quits until it is stamped out. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.